Hi everyone, just a quick note before we start today's podcast. We were extremely lucky to get to have a long conversation with Professor Anthony Reddy, and it ended up taking about 2 hours. It probably could have gone on for another 6 hours because he has so many interesting and worthwhile things to say, and we had a lot of questions to ask, but unfortunately we all had to go and do other things. We've decided to split the episode into two so you don't miss out on any of the really good stuff that Anthony had to say. The first episode is this one, and the second episode will come out next week. We hope you enjoy them both. Welcome to Bread and Rosaries, a podcast about the UK, Christianity, and the left. I'm Ben Molyneux-Hetherington, and my pronouns are he, him. As always, I'm joined by the Marx to my Engels, Adam Spears, whose pronouns are also he, him. Hi, Adam.
How you doing?
Was that nicer than some of the previous intros?
Better than last week's. What was last week's? That was awful. I'll take that. I mean, obviously, you know, just to get you laughing at me as usual for saying this, obviously I come from a more anarchist tradition, but it's certainly better than it was last week.
Yeah, well, I figured it was mainly because I'm the posh one of the two, so it made more sense for me to be the Engels.
Yeah, that does make sense.
We are extremely lucky this week to be joined by Professor Anthony Reddy. Hello, Anthony.
Yes, hello. It's a real privilege to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. We will talk a little bit in a bit about who you are for the poor, uneducated people who don't know of you. But it is an absolute pleasure to have you with us. We're going to start, as always, with our segment, What Else Is On My Mind Grapes?
What else is on my mind grapes?
Adam, I think you wanted to start because you sent me a link and said, I just want to rant about this. So if you can keep it reasonably short.
Yeah. I apologise in advance. We've probably seen some of the things that have been going on at Napier Barracks, which is a decommissioned army barracks in Folkestone, which happens to be my hometown. Now, Napier Barracks has been hosting a group of refugees that were sent there whilst they are awaiting processing. And recently, there have been disturbances. And there was a fire that was started, and a lot of destruction and that kind of thing. And this has basically come about because Napier Barracks is not fit for purpose. So what we know about it, obviously, is that it's a decommissioned army barracks, which is, I mean, let's paint a picture. You know, you've traveled thousands of miles fleeing something like war or poverty or both, crossed a dangerous sea to get here, and then you are essentially arrested and put in a decommissioned army barracks. Now, army barracks are, you know, that militaristic kind of lifestyle and things that go with that are not going to be helpful to someone who probably has a significant amount of trauma from what they've experienced. Now, the other thing is I want to say about this is we've got our favourite person, Priti Patel, coming out very strongly against this and saying that, you know, the people, the destruction is, quote, deeply offensive to the taxpayers of this country. And a number of people have now been arrested for this. I want to let people know, I want to say this. It being my hometown, I happen to have stayed at Napier Barracks. I know what it's like. Some years ago now, before it was decommissioned. And it is not good. It wasn't fit for purpose back then. Cramming people, desperate people, traumatized people into confined spaces with cold water and, you know, I mean, we're talking 30, 40 beds a room, during a pandemic is a terrible, terrible way to treat people. And I cannot, I don't know if this is coming across, but I cannot say how angry I am about this, particularly, actually, because my hometown has a bit of a checkered record, like most places, on refugees' rights and how people respond to refugees coming into their town. There's been a lot of backlash on this, people protesting outside it as if it wasn't bad enough already. So the whole situation is deeply disturbing and shames us, frankly. And that's my rant. Thank you for thank you for listening.
I think it's probably worth mentioning, you know, the actual situation in Napier Barracks with coronavirus is that now over a quarter of the people who are staying there have tested positive. Yeah. Simply with what we know about coronavirus, it's going to get a higher and higher proportion, because if you have a quarter of the people there is simply no space to self-isolate those people. You know, it is quite likely that the majority of people in Napier Barracks will end up with coronavirus. And one thing that you've got to remember about, as you said, these are traumatized people. I know, because I work with refugees, and these are people who are affected by trauma every day of their lives, and it affects physical health as well as mental health. Yeah. And there will be people there who are, because of the trauma and because distinctly possibly of the medical conditions they may well have, you know, ended up with en route due to some of the treatment they've got, will be at more risk of something like coronavirus.
It's worth saying as well, worth mentioning, now I don't know if this is still the case, but certainly it was and may still be, that after that incident, all the staff there withdrew. So for a long time, and potentially still now, the only staff there were police and security services. And so they are going to be woefully ill-equipped to deal with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something else that's worth saying, is that there has been a decrease in the number of asylum seekers in the UK due to COVID. And it's worth reiterating once again that the idea that we are in the midst of some sort of crisis of refugees coming to this country is statistical nonsense. And it is purely generated by an attempt to turn these people, desperate, hurting, traumatized people, into a political football that we can be used to appeal to certain segments of our society and certain voter groups. But the reality is that it's not that we are having to desperately find emergency refugee accommodation because the amount of refugees has gone up. That is simply not what's happened.
No.
Putting people in disused barracks is pretty much just political theatre. There's no need for it. It exists purely as a, you know, piece of political theatre.
I mean, I think you both have stated it very, very clearly. It is the way in which I think the media, plus a very, I think, sort of trenchant right-wing government emboldened by Brexit and white English nationalism, that has enabled us to have a sense in which even the vaguest moral compass has been so skewed that any sense of decency has just completely gone out the window. And then I think worst of all, actually have a Home Secretary whose own lived experience should mean that she should know better, but doesn't, because she's buying into, quite frankly, what is an atrocious right-wing regime. And she's playing along with it. And so the levels of my contempt, I will probably keep to myself, lest I end up probably being sued somewhere along the line for for defamation. So we'll keep that to myself. But let's just say that I think that your viewers can guess at the level of my contempt, I think, really, for everything that this government is doing.
I think you're in good company, because I'm surprised we haven't been sued yet. It might just be that, like, nobody listens to us.
Yeah, the legal defence of we're not prominent enough for it to really count.
Yeah, exactly.
There was a few other things that happened that we just wanted to skim by. Related to that is the confirmation that the Stansted 15's appeal was successful in the High Court. Stansted 15 were 15 people who stopped a flight taking off at Stansted because it was full of what the government would refer to as illegal immigrants or failed asylum seekers. A number of them have now allowed to be, have now allowed to stay in the country. So clearly they weren't as quite a strong illegal case to get rid of them as they thought. But the Stansted 15 were actually charged not with the crime that they thought they were going to be charged with, but with a relatively obscure terrorism related charge. And the judge at the High Court has overthrown that and said that there was in reality never any case to answer, which is a very good bit of news. And yeah, I don't think there's loads more to say on that, but it is fantastic to see.
It is indicative, though, that the fact that a number of those people have been now being given leave to remain is indicative of the fact that we have a government who are moving very quickly to deport people before their appeals process has been exhausted. And that again plays into that political theatre.
Another thing that we wanted to note is that there is this ongoing controversy about the CPS, the Criminal Prosecution Service, and prosecuting rape cases. Essentially, they seem to have put in a much, much higher burden of proof to prosecute rape cases anymore. And therefore, we have seen a huge fall in the number of successful rape prosecutions without any sort of fall in the number of rape and sexual assaults sadly happening. This is kind of an ongoing case, and there is a legal challenge into the CPS. It's been referred to as almost a de facto legalization of rape in this country, and I think it is something quite shocking, really, to see just how casual it is to actually take away the consequences, legal consequences that are meant to take place. You know, we don't have to support the carceral system and the way justice, quote unquote, works in this country to acknowledge that, you know, there is a clear double standard here, and it is good for nobody that rape cases are not being prosecuted as they should be.
It's also worth mentioning that this is another one of those culture war issues, because this kind of thing has been brought up by men's rights activists for some years now, when actually we know that statistically, even before this, the number of rapes that were actually prosecuted was very, very small. But clearly, yeah, again, we have a government that is trying to play to an audience here. And that audience in this case is men's rights activists and those who are, yeah, acquiescent to that way of thinking.
Jesus weeps for Gaza. He sees the pain and suffering of the 1.9 million people who have been forced to leave their homes without access to nutritious food, clean water, decent shelter. He hears the cries of the 25,000 orphaned children. He is with all who mourn the 250 people killed every single day. Christians for Palestine UK is a group of Christians who are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but are united in our prayers, hope and action for equality, peace and justice for all the peoples of the Holy Land. Together, we are organising a Christian presence at the National Marches for Palestine and local Days of Action, where we've been joined by siblings from Sabil Kairos, Pax Christi and a whole range of Christian churches. We urge you to join us to act in solidarity with the people of Palestine and call for a permanent ceasefire and just peace. The Very Reverend Canon Richard Sewell, Dean of St George's College in Jerusalem, says, "I warmly welcome the newly formed group, Christians for Palestine UK. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank need to see the solidarity of Christians in the UK, and they will be encouraged to see your commitment to stand up for them in their time of terrible suffering. To find details of local actions or to join the Christian bloc at a national march, follow Christians for Palestine UK on Instagram and Facebook, or email christiansforpalestineuk@gmail.com. Join us as we call for a ceasefire now.
Yeah, and I think it's important to link those things together because it is the same people doing the same things, and you know, both in terms of understanding where it's coming from, but also building a viable coalition to oppose this sort of stuff means, you know, bringing in both migrant rights and feminist opposition to these cases and, you know, all these sorts of things together, because it's only together that you can actually successfully oppose that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the area in which I work, which I will perhaps say a little bit more about shortly, in terms of black and womanist theologies, that one of the key books came out about 15 years ago by a woman called Emily Towns, and the book is called Womanist Ethics and the Cultural Production of Evil. And that's what she says that, like, you've always had this coalition of interest between, I guess, whiteness, white hegemony, white supremacy, the media, obviously run by very powerful people who can skew that, and right-wing politics. And their greatest trick is to pretend that their position is a normative neutral one. So basically it's women, it's minorities, it's other lefties like us. I said like yourself. I mean, like myself, you know. I mean, all three of us are on that side. Sorry. Make it look like it's you and I'm somehow something different. No. All of us. And that's somehow we're the problem, because actually we're the ones who are pushing against a natural scheme of things, because clearly the world as it's been constituted is exactly as it should be, and certainly within a theological context, that's how God wants it to be. So therefore, it's these dangerous radicals who are sort of trying to skew the process and bring in all these other isms, and therefore like their attack against sort of critical race theory, and against movements around sort of decolonizing knowledge and history, are seen as dangerous aberrations, when actually the real dangerous aberration is the status quo that has been oppressing people like for the best part of a millennia, and has couched itself under the guise of normality with, I think, the clear witting support of the media that then constructs people like feminists and people like minority rights as being these dangerous people who need to be at best disregarded and at worst, I think, kind of neutralized, you know. And I think you're absolutely right that it needs a coalition of support from all the various groups on the left to say actually that what we're battling against is a status quo that represents empire.
It's the same war but different battles. Yeah. Effectively. Yeah. It's probably worth saying as well, because we are apparently a Christian podcast, that Christians and the church is allied with a lot of this stuff as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, the amount of times I can, you know, I've encountered people when I've complained about something genuinely and plainly awful that needs to be changed happening, where they'll say, oh, well, Romans 13, submit to the governing authorities. And it's like, you can't do anything with that.
No.
And you're placing God in this kind of, it's incredible as well, because it often comes from people who have quite an interventionist idea of God.
Yeah.
So God can intervene,
yeah.
But for whatever reason, he just isn't. On this particular issue, and neither should we.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating mixture of beliefs there.
I think we should head in to the topic at hand, which is that, as I said, we have Professor Anthony Reddy with us. As you can tell by the title Professor, Anthony is an academic based currently at Oxford University, and he is one of the foremost proponents of black theology in the UK. He is the editor of Black Theology and International Journal, and he is author of many books over a number of years. And in particular, your most recent one was God is Colorblind. God is colorblind. That's the opposite of what you're saying. which is a reissue of an older book that includes a very interesting afterword reflecting on the kind of Black Lives Matter movement in the UK. So we will talk about all that sort of thing. But I think probably we should start with the most obvious question, which is, what is Black theology? So could you describe it to us kind of as a field and maybe place yourself within it as well?
Indeed. Yeah, so Black theology, or to give it its full nomenclature, because I think that's the important thing, is it's Black liberation theology, is really a faith-based approach to challenging white supremacy and the heresy of whiteness as a sign and a system of superiority. Its roots actually go back to the period of enslavement. So one of the things I often say in introductions to my talks, I mention Reddy. Reddy is a slave name. R-E-D-D-I-E is not an African name. It's a name actually from Scotland. It actually comes from Perthshire. And therefore, what that tells you is that at some point in the past, probably at some point in the 17th and 18th century, someone from Scotland or of Scottish descent in the Caribbean, particularly the island of Jamaica, where my parents are from, owned one of my ancestors. And so the roots of Black theology really come out of enslaved people rethinking the Christianity that had been imposed upon them. So initially, Christianity was given to them as a means of pacifying them and making them better and more passive and more docile slaves. And certainly the imposition of teaching, particularly from Paul, thinking particularly of Ephesians 6:5 and Colossians 3:22 in both contexts, where Paul exhorts slaves to obey their masters, that these texts would have been used as a means of trying to pacify and make enslaved Africans more accepting of the social context in which they were living. What they did not expect is that what the enslaved people did is that they discovered within the midst of this colonial oppression, this religion of oppression, was an alternative understanding of Jesus. A Jesus who was a liberator, a Jesus who was not on the side of the Romans, but actually who was on the side of landless, dispossessed, marginal people in his day. And what they did actually was, I think, a really sophisticated theological analogy, which was that their sense of that the Jesus who was on the side of those who were marginalized and resistant Roman oppression, if God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, then where then would that God be located within the midst of their struggles? And they were clear that God would be, in terms of building Christ, on their side, helping them like to resist their contemporary Roman tyranny in terms of British oppression on the Caribbean islands. Fast forward then into the 20th century, and I guess the big systemic change is that James H. Cone, who's often seen as the grand patriarch of Black theology, Cone would have always said that he did not invent Black theology. His argument, and I would agree with him, that for as long as people of African descent have seen in God a form of resistance to white hegemony, there's obviously been a form of Black theology. Cone's genius was to write it down in a systematic framework to say, well, in this comprehensive rethinking of the nature of God, as revealed particularly in Jesus, Cone then was rethinking all the existing ideas and doctrines and frameworks that have been created by white people with power to say, actually, these things don't apply to us. They should not apply to people who have been oppressed, because basically they have been developed with a very form of self-interest. Therefore, his first major book was Black Theology and Black Power. And really what Cone was doing in his time was to say that the same way that obviously contemporary media, and particularly on the right, would demonize the Black Lives Matter movement in our context, then back in the 60s, like they were doing the same like with the Black Power movement. And Cohen was saying, Black Power is more Christian than most of the white people who go to church and say they worship God, but still hate black people and still subscribe to white supremacy. So black liberation theology is a theology of protest, a theology of a movement of liberation that has its roots in Christianity, but actually didn't have to be Christian. So like you do get some black theologians who are in Islam, some are in Judaism, some are in African traditional religions. So they tend to be in a variety of religious perspectives. But for the most part, I think if you were to take 10 black theologians across the world, 9 would be Christian. I locate myself in that movement. I guess the significant difference between myself and maybe most of the African-Americans who are black theologians, most black theologians are African-Americans. They, after all, kind of started the intellectual movement. James Cone was born in Bearden, Arkansas. So it's very much an American-dominated movement. For me, I guess there's two things, really. One is, as a child of the British Empire, my parents come from the island, as I said, come from the island of Jamaica. And therefore, as someone who's born and brought up in Bradford, West Yorkshire, I'm a child of migrants. And therefore, I think a significant difference between us African-Americans who have been on the American continent for 400 years in terms of being enslaved people, or the roots of enslaved people. For someone like myself, my parents came as part of the Windrush generation. So for my, so I guess black theology in Britain, myself, Robert Beckford, and other notable people in the British context, for us, I guess a colonial critique is a major part of what we're doing that you don't find so much in the American context. So for us, black theology in Britain, you can't do it without thinking about British Empire. You can't do it without thinking about mission and colonialism and the fact that the British had possession of the largest empire the world's ever seen at its peak, just under a quarter of the world. And so that's the larger canvas in which my work has operated. So that's pretty much part of that. And then I guess like the last thing to say very quickly is that as someone whose roots come out of activism, so I came out of being a community worker, community activist, became an academic almost by accident, really. And although at the moment I am ensconced in the very rarefied and privileged world of Oxford, there's a sense in which, as much as that's been an enjoyable experience, I mean, I've only been there for just over a year, there's also a part of me that doesn't quite feel I belong. And I think I will probably always nurture that sense of not quite belonging, because I think there's something about my own activism as a socialist / Marxist / probably sort of Trotskyist, I guess sort of black liberation theologian, that ultimately it's about practice. It's about what we do on the ground to bring about change. And the writing is simply a reflection of what we believe should happen first and foremost, which is forms of revolutionary change. I'm not someone who writes simply for the sake of doing so. And so I've never seen myself as being part of the academic establishment in that regard.
It's really one of the things that I was really fascinated with when you were talking there was you brought up James Cone, and you sort of towards the end there as well, talking about being an accidental academic. And the interesting thing you said was that what James Cone did, the genius of what he did, was systematizing something that had existed for a long time already. And one of the things I found fascinating when I read probably his most famous book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, is, you know, well, the whole point of that book is really that black people have seen this parallel between lynchings and Jesus's crucifixion as long as there have been lynchings. But for white people, that was, in, you know, a book coming out in the 20th century making that, you know, parallel obvious was really shocking and surprising. And it's interesting, isn't it, that we do, so often we see theology basically through a very white and a very academic lens, when actually theology is happening and being done by people and being done perhaps most authentically by people who are not only people who are on the ground, but by people who are having that lived experience.
Indeed, absolutely. I mean, I think one of my favourite quotes about the substantial difference between how historically black people, especially those of us who are diaspora Africans who have our roots in enslavement, have seen Christianity, and for the most part, not necessarily all white people, but certainly white privileged individuals. Actually, it comes from this quote by James Baldwin, who says, it says, white people discovered the cross through the Bible, but black people discovered the Bible through the cross. Mm. And essentially what he's saying is that one of the earliest things I remember when I was growing up in Sunday school, this long before I knew anything about black theology, didn't know anything about black theology at all, but I had heard the stories of the struggles of black people, heard about our travails, and actually had had an uncle who was very, very learned. And I remember him talking about lynching, because he'd been in America in the late 50s before he came to the UK. We're talking about lynching. It was the first time I remember sitting in Sunday school and being taught about the crucifixion and Jesus going to Golgotha. The first thought I remember having years ago, I must have been about 8 or 9, was that this is the kind of death that black people have. That I don't know white people who die like this. This is how black people die. And having had that thought, I then suppressed it, because growing up in a white majority middle class church, white evangelical church, where all the symbols and all the interpretation, everything was done through a Eurocentric lens, and my parents not being particularly radical, they were very, very pro-black and very proud, but also, I think, realistically, given their level of education and being migrants, their role was, their sense of resistance was to keep your head down and stay out of trouble. And what passes resistance would be much more informal. So it would be a case of not letting people kill your spirit, not letting them break you psychologically or emotionally, just keep on keeping on, even in the midst of real dehumanization in terms of working class Bradford. And so because I had no outlet for that particular thought in my head, it literally bounced around my inner being. I was about, as I said, about 8 or 9 for about the next 15 to 20 years. So really, it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s to late 20s that I suddenly discovered black theology. And one of the most remarkable things when I read my first black theology book, which was Black Theology and Black Power by James Cone, was how unremarkable it was. You know, I mean, I remember reading and not being shocked. It was like, oh, okay, so someone is essentially saying the things I've had in my head, like for the last 20-odd years. Okay, so I'm not crazy. I'm not thinking these dangerous thoughts that are not really Christian, so I'll keep them to myself. What Cone is saying, well, basically, actually, this is the true essence of Christianity. If you're not on the side of the poor, if you're not on the side of the marginalized, if you're not speaking truth to power, then you're not doing it properly. Actually, whatever God you're worshipping, that's not the God of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And certainly, I think one of Cone's boldest assertions was that, like, the white Christ is the Antichrist. And I still subscribe to that.
Something that I was really struck by is you've described black theology as the thing that enabled you to stay within Christianity despite its many, many flaws, which I thought was a really... I found that a really interesting way of phrasing that. And I kind of feel like that's what you were driving at there, is that it offers that idea of Christianity worth staying in. So I guess what is it about black theology that makes Christianity worth sticking with?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it has done at its best is that it has reminded us of, I think, two crucial things. Firstly, is that across the whole descriptors, that the God of the Judeo-Christian tradition is a God who is a supporter of those on the margins, is a supporter of the underdog, is a supporter of those who are deemed to be unacceptable. God makes acceptable by God making God's own home with them and their identification with them. So when you look at a God's identification with the people in the Old Testament, Hebrews, Jewish people, that actually, you know, if you look at any ancient map, these are a tiny, insignificant group of people compared, like, to Babylonians and compared to Persians and other empires that are massive. So there's something quite distinctive about a God who identifies with a particular group of people. Not because these people are special in and of themselves, just because God says, well, actually, it's too easy to identify with the powerful. I will identify with those who are powerless, and they will be my people. Skip to the New Testament, and Jesus fulfills all of that and then personalizes it in his own self. And so for me, I guess growing up against the edifice of, at best, the Christianity I experienced when I was growing up, at best it was polite and nice and genial, in the sense in which the people who taught me the faith were, on the whole, not terrible people. They were decent people. They were kind and generous. But it was unremittingly white and was very much part of the status quo. So I remember, just very quickly, that one of my first acts of defiance, and for the most part, I was not a particularly rebellious child. I like to restyle my formative years that I was a prototypical Marxist, activist revolutionary. I was nothing of the sort. I was a quiet bookish nerd, basically. And my only real act of rebellion was at age 16, 17. I remember Bradford University started the first peace studies department. And the guy who was running it was a very, a sort of left-wing Marxist, can't remember his name. And he had the first chair in peace studies. And this was really controversial in Bradford, because obviously this is early 80s. This is the era of Thatcherism. This is the era of the Labour Party being led by Michael Foot, who has Labour adopting a position of unilateral disarmament, which, of course, has been pilloried and attacked by the right-wing media. And actually attacked even amongst church folks. So I still remember, and you just can't make this stuff up, a church leader in our church pushing for a boycott. So what had happened was that one of the younger ministers had invited this professor of peace studies to come to the church. Come to the church, tell us about what you're trying to do in terms of peace studies. But because he was a left-wing discipline, because he himself was a Marxist, because he was also part of CND, there was a boycott of the meeting. So normally within our youth fellowship, whereas a guest speaker would come out, you get 40, 50 people in the room. I'd listen to a guest speaker. This time, we had six. Basically, most of the churches boycotted this. And I remember this church leader in our church saying, this is just left-wing propaganda. And I quote, "What has peace got to do with Jesus anyway?"
Wow. Wow.
And it's let me think. He's a Prince of Peace, maybe,
Just Sounds like heresy to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, something about 40-odd people, only six of us turned up, but I was one of the six. And I remember another leader saying to my parents, "I don't think you should let Anthony come to this meeting." And my parents were normally, as I said, fairly passive, not particularly radical. They said, "Well, we brought Anthony up to be sensible and to think for himself. If he wants to go to the meeting, then that's up to him." And I think that was probably the best bit of support they gave me. But at that point, obviously, that wasn't the norm. The norm was this was a church that supported the status quo, was pro-Thatcher, pro-holding nuclear arms. Somehow it's Christian, to be prepared, to nuke other people. And somehow it's anti-Christian, to talk about peace and to say that these weapons are ungodly. And so I think what black theology did for me was to carry, I think, a lot of the radical leftist positions of Christianity that have kind of always existed, but at their worst, they've still been racist, they've still been wrapped around whiteness. So what black theology did for me is to say there was another way of being Christian that was in the tradition of a radical Jesus that was challenging empires, challenging the status quo, and prepared to speak truth to power. And for me, that made being a Christian something still worth hanging on to at a time when I could have easily have left it just thinking, well, actually, why am I going to align myself with churches, certainly, again, thinking back to that era, who were often pro-South Africa, often against sanctions, and often not, and I said often, too easily sucked into supporting the status quo.
It's one of the things that's really fascinating about that is you're talking about how your parents aren't particularly radical in that way, and yet they have a point of view that is clearly not like those who are going to that church, because it's informed by being black, by being migrants, by their experience. And I find that really fascinating, because you have, you know, particularly in that moment where they've said, actually, we've brought Anthony up to, you know, make decisions for himself and to do that well. Sorry, I've probably bastardized your quote there. but it's, what's really interesting about that is that you've almost got this kind of base or basis from which to build your radicalness, you know, if that's the right word. And the other thing, it sort of reminds me, I was reflecting quite recently, actually, with a good friend of mine about how there are parallels, because men and leftist men as well, whatever that means, often are, you know, they're very vocal about dismantling, you know, systems of oppression if they're leftist men. And yet they often will dismiss books by feminists or womanists as being not for them and not about them. And it seems to me that there's a parallel there between white people and black theology and black liberation theology. And I wonder, like, why is that, and how can we overcome that? How can we challenge that?
Yeah. I think one of the key things I remember when I was studying for my doctorate was this fantastic, well, it's not a quote, but it's this observation by Gustavo Gutierrez, who's, I guess, like the James Cone equivalent for Latin American liberation theology. And so Gutierrez, he says, God's preferential option for the poor and the marginalized isn't because there is something inherently superior or better about being poor. Because he says, actually, all of us as human beings are guilty of being sinful in terms of being trapped within our own self-interest and not always being able to see the needs of others. That God's preferential option for the poor is because God is righteous and just. And therefore, people who are suffering, that's where God is. And I say that to say that I think if there's one critique that one could generally make of a lot of the initial developments of liberation theologies, is that whilst they were very, very good at systemic analysis, very, very good at being able to analyze structures and to see them as being sinful and to see sin embedded within the ways in which we think about the world and how it operates and what is normative, there was a temptation to underestimate the existing understandings around how there's something intrinsic within humanity that means that we ourselves actually can be caught up in sin. And I say all that to say that I guess one of the fault lines has always been that if we think of liberation theologies in too binary a fashion, so for example, if it's black theology, it's about, okay, so what we're fighting is racism. White people are racist, black people can't be because we don't have the power. Therefore, that's the fight. And it's like, well, okay, that's one trajectory. But actually, there are other trajectories that we have to also be mindful of that run parallel to that particular one. And so the danger always is, I think with any particular type of identity politics, is the danger of being trapped into a particular singular narrative that then doesn't see the irony of needing to broaden one's gaze so that what you then don't do, but sometimes you do at the worst, is to see the irony of then holding to positions on other interest groups or interest areas or other concerns and using an argument that undermines like the very thing that you've been fighting for in terms of the singular perspective that you were fighting for. So look, I'll give you one example. I still remember, and I was too silent in the past, I would not collude that now, with black theologians who would argue against the scriptures in terms of Paul's injunction that slaves should obey their masters. They would say, no, no, no. We need to read against the text. We can't take Paul literally. We got to challenge that. We got to see it in its context. We've also got to acknowledge that actually human experience is a text, that like the ongoing experience of being human and the intersection of the spirit that enables us to live in the world is as important as fossilized pieces of writing that were written thousands of years ago. You know, that's a basic premise of liberation theology. Yet, in the next heartbeat, those same people will then say, well, of course, you know, I'm like, we're anti-gay. Oh, why? Oh, because Paul, the same one that like we were critiquing a moment ago, because actually, we can't read him literally when it comes to his understanding of enslaved people, and we ourselves come from enslaved people. So we'll critique Paul in terms of his collusion, seeming collusion with oppression around slavery. But now, of course, he seemingly condemns people who are, I guess, homosexual, obviously, which is a modern term, that term would have existed in biblical terms, but obviously people whose sexual identity is seen as transgressive. But suddenly now we will read with the text, and we will suddenly take this complete about turn and adopt a particular methodology that we would never do when it was in conversation with the primary issue that we're fighting against, and ditto with sexism. And patriarchy. So, you know, again, men will fight against racism and say, you know, black liberational theology, and then turn around and say, oh, yeah, but Paul says that wives should be submissive to the husband. Yeah, but like, this is the same guy who, like, a few months ago, like you were sort of saying, like, we shouldn't take him literally. Therefore, I think one of the later developments in liberational theology is this thing around intersectionality, which is just simply to say that, as you said, it's that there's a common war we're fighting. There are individual battles within it. But actually, if we make the mistake of not joining in coalition, what we end up inevitably doing is contradicting ourselves. That those people who don't hold in tension the needs to be in solidarity with other groups will inevitably end up turning around and trying to exhort a particular type of theological method or an approach that they would never endorse, particularly if that were applied to them.
So on that kind of note, you've kind of previously indicated in some of your writing that womanist theology, that is a kind of black and female approach to theology, which is quite prevalent in the US, has yet to really take root in the UK. But obviously, you are a male theologian, so I don't expect or think it would be useful to have you kind of spend the next hour talking about womanist theology.
No.
But I am interested to kind of know if you see a development of a kind of UK-based womanist theology kind of coming through.
Yes, there is, in two respects. So firstly is that obviously because, as I said before, I think one of the key things that we have to do within the British context is to talk about empire, because empire is part of the reason why we're here, you know. I mean, one of the reasons I'm here, well, backtrack. So when I was an undergraduate, I used to have a poster that was produced by the Anti-Racist Alliance, and it was this picture taken on Brixton High Road, sort of Brixton Market, circa early 70s, and so you got this picture of people from all over the world, but particularly a lot of black Caribbean people shopping on a Saturday. And underneath was a caption that read, "We are here because you were there." Mm-hmm. We are here because you were there. So you cannot talk about migrant communities in Britain without talking about empire. And all the places where white people went first, uninvited, not as underpaid migrants, but as people who had usurped other people's lands and had colonized them within an empire. All that to say that one of the earliest versions, I think, of womanist theology has been one that was developed by Caribbean women who had sort of come from the Caribbean into Britain, and particularly of Jamaican descent. And so what you have is still a relatively small movement called Nannyish theology. So Nannyish theology is named after a woman called Nanny of the Maroons. So she was an anti-imperial, anti-slavery woman leader of the small sect within enslaved people on Jamaica called the Maroons. These are people of African descent. They came from a particular part of Africa, and they tend to have a shared identity. And they were largely in the mountainous area called Cockpit Country. And she ran the successful guerrilla fight against the British to the point whereby the British actually sued for peace and gave the Maroons a degree of freedom that they didn't give the rest of the enslaved population. We don't know much about Nanny, because obviously all we know is what was written about her in the colonial records, of the people who were trying to catch her, but I never did catch her. And so she is one of the six national heroes in Jamaica, like the only one who's a woman. And therefore, so for Caribbean women, particularly for Jamaican women, like they call it nannyist theology, which is like a Caribbean British version of womanist theology. Obviously, that's of a certain generation for women who are born in the Caribbean or come to Britain. Amongst the younger generation, obviously, that won't resonate in the same way. And what we've seen is the early emergence now of a newer generation of womanists. I certainly was at university, well, certainly after my doctorate in the mid-90s, with a whole number of women who were that first generation of womanists. A number of articles that were published in the early issues of Black Theology in Britain, for example, and in some of the edited books I did back in the 90s and early 2000s. The disappointing thing was, and I think maybe this is kind of linked, again, I think, like to the kind of nature of colonialism, that as British churches have been much more conservative than American churches. So one of the things that makes America distinctive is that they've always had this Black independent church tradition that was started by enslaved Africans and has always been, and always had an element of radicalism in it. So although they have been sexist, most of the womanists still came out of that tradition and were able to find careers both in the church and in the academy to develop their work. Because there's no equivalent within the British context, what we have are either very conservative Pentecostal churches or, on the other hand, very white neo-colonial churches like the one I belong to, which is the Methodist Church, but Anglican Church, Catholics and others. Therefore, I think one of the things that's impeded the development of womanist theology in Britain has been certainly that first generation founder I was studying with in the 90s, is that once you do your PhD and you begin to write, then where do you go? Because that, it's hard to get a job in a university. There's not one Black woman who's a professor in theology in Britain as we speak, not one. You can count the number of Black women who have jobs in theological colleges on one hand. Best to my knowledge, I think there's only about three or four of them. Not sure how many Black women have academic theological jobs at universities. Top of my head, I can't think of any. There may be one or two, but I don't know them. And until quite recently, most of the historic churches didn't ordain Black women. So therefore, I think one of the things that's impeded its development has been, well, actually, even if you do your work and you study, then where do you go? Now, it's beginning to change. And hopefully, I think in the next 10 or so years, we will see the emergence of Black British-born womanist theologians who will begin like, to develop their work. They'll begin to write, and hopefully they'll have careers either in the church or the academy or both. So that's the hope.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think it's really insightful that actually for all the feminist advances, you know, when you come at it with that intersectional lens, you start to realise that, you know, for Black women, the advances made in women's power and theological circles has not been extended to the same extent to Black women as it has to white women. And I think it's really important to kind of, you know, see that the history of feminism is sadly often the history of white women getting rights.
Yeah.
I love the idea of then taking that name of Nanny of the Maroons, because that really, I mean, that makes complete sense. And also, just to say, I hadn't heard of her, but she sounds like a right badass. She sounds so cool.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there's all kinds of stories that have been shaped about her. So in some respects, she's almost like a Jamaican version of sort of Robin Hood. Mm. So, you know, it's like there are even big questions to whether Nanny ever existed or not historically, because what's been poured onto it, all these kind of layers, you know. So, for example, like there's one story of Nanny firing arrows from her vagina to, you know, to shoot out and to kill white officers. And it's like, whoa, you know, I mean, like, she's kick-ass, man.
That's amazing.
That's so much cooler than Robin Hood.
Yeah. So much cooler than Robin Hood. Yeah, you know. And so, yeah, and so certainly in Jamaica, and to a lesser extent in Britain, in terms of Jamaican women who have lived over here, you find people who will write as nanny theologians. Mm. Probably like the leading nannyist theologian in the UK at the moment is a Reverend Dr. Evie Vernon, She's part of the leading nannies theologian in Britain at the moment. She's an Anglican.
All the best people are. I note that we've had you're the second Methodist we've had on in as many podcasts, so it's almost like the Methodists are taking over now.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Bread and Rosaries. The second half of our conversation with Professor Anthony Reddy will be out next week, so look forward to that. You can find us in all your usual podcast feed places. We're on facebook.com/breadandrosaries, on Twitter at @bread_rosaries, and you can email us at breadandrosaries@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening. We will see you next time.